Accession number 16726, Mr. H. Bell, reel 12.
Mr. Bell, reel 12. You must have been pretty tired and exhausted after spending so long under such conditions. Did you get the opportunity to relax at all, to rest, sleep, catch up on the things that bring your energies back?
We were down just a few days, I think it was, in Dimapo at the camp. And then we moved up into, well, you could call it a rest position. We were in reserve at a hill. Very interesting period in my life, this. Up a hill, about 4,000 or 5,000 feet, at the crown of a hill, Jotsima village, occupied by Naga hillsmen. The Naga hillsmen are headhunters, or ex-headhunters. They had been headhunters in the past, and there was still the remains around the village. And it was a stockaded village, right on the top of a hill, this huge stockade, right round a ring of what you might call planks, but weren't. The Nagas are very, very, very primitive people. They don't have very good tools, and so when they made a plank, they took a tree and they whittled it down till they had one piece left in the middle, and then they bored holes in it and fastened them together. But that was one plank, one tree, and they had up there. And what I particularly remember about the village, shall I say, first of all, they were marvellous people. I shall never forget them. I shall never forget how nice they were. Primitive people, as I'll tell you later on. And the doorway to this fortification was one slab of wood, about a yard wide, and carved in semi-relief, there was a full-length figure of a headhunter, with his arms by his sides, and a head in each hand held by a tuft of hair at the top. I've got to be careful here. The eyes were green glass, the lips were red, and the handle of the door was an intriguing handle. The handle of the door intrigued me, and it intrigued everybody else, because it was a large extended penis which you grasped to open the door with. And they were the whole door painted black, but this penis was a bright red. And as I say, the whole fence was these huge planks, about 8 inches thick. An awful lot of work involved, and whittled down with hand axes and knives. And the whole village went up to the very top of the hill in steps to a fighting platform, a last stand platform on the top, where that was the last stand, you know. And they were lovely people. I shall never, never forget them. They were lovely people. The most magnificent bodies I've ever seen. They had thigh muscles which stood up like ropes. They went up and down that hill twice, three times, four times a day, 4,000, 5,000 feet down to the rice paddy fields at the bottom, carrying loads up, carrying loads down, and the development of their bodies was magnificent, absolutely magnificent. They had thighs about as thick as my body.
They were a great help to the army, weren't they?
Yes, they were a great help to the army. I shall cover that later.
Have they appeared at Kohima, then, the tribesmen?
Have they what?
Have they appeared at Kohima to help you?
No. No. They were Ah, they were dressed. I'll cover this. It's an interesting thing. I've often talked to people like this, and everybody's been interested, so I suppose. Anyway, they had their hair cropped short, excepting for the scalp lock. Large tuft of hair tied with a bit of string on right the top of their head. I assume it was to hang the head of by, but it got cut off. And they had a collar of beads, a big collar, about 4 inches wide. Beautifully, beautiful colour, decorated with red, blue, white, yellow beads, all also in a pattern, like a very large dog collar, to protect the neck, I suppose, from the knife. And they had rows and rows and rows of glass beads, all different colours, hanging down over their chest. Rows and rows and rows of them. And on their arms, they had slices of elephant tusks. Six inch slices cut across and ringed round the biceps. They wore a kind of a kilt, a sort of a sporran pouch thing. And round their legs, which as I say were highly developed, they had, I think it was black bamboo fibre dyed black, wound round and round and round above their calves. The calves of their legs were bulging as if there was Christmas stocking full of oranges, and they carried a spear, which is rather like a shovel, a huge broad blade, about a foot across, spear shaped naturally, and a big knife. I don't know how they didn't cut themselves. Big sharp jungle knife, which is about 3 foot long. Very broad, and then we carried them ourselves, what they call the dar, and they carried them in this wooden socket arrangement on their waist, and they were happy people. They were happy. They'd laugh while they were cutting your head up. they were happy. The only people, and the MO told me, the only coloured people he had ever come across who were allowed to work in our cookhouse. The wives, they were so clean, spotlessly clean, and they were allowed to work in the cookhouse. And they were, anyway, I hope this isn't boring, I was stationed with a radio set on the veranda of the chief's hut. I'll call it the chief's hut, but it wasn't that, it was actually a portion of a hut. They lived in a, how do you call it when people live together, all the families in one hut? I don't know. Anyway, it doesn't matter. A long hut. And they all lived in this hut, but the chief had this top portion. It was we were on the veranda with the radio. I have a picture of it. And there was a table. The table was cut out of one huge tree trunk. A vertical section was an H lying on its side. Well, it was cut out like out of one solid piece of wood. And at the back, behind the radio set, there were rattan, I think it is, like bamboo woven curtain was there, and inside the hut, there was a fire burning all the time. Fire burning, and there were four huge logs stretching from each corner of the room towards the middle, and the fire was lit, and these, the ends of these logs were burning and kept redder, and they kept moving them in from the corners. They also sat on them, so they served two purposes, fire and seating. In the corner of the room there were three large clay jars full of rice beer. And the amusing part is, when I was off duty, I used to sit on, no, it should come later, we went there, we used to get the rice beer, and he had two daughters, the headman had two daughters, beautiful daughters. They were the beautiful people. They weren't Indian, they're more like a Chinese, they had slanted eyes and high cheekbones. They were beautiful girls, lovely. But we were warned when we went on, don't touch the girls, else you'd go back without your manhood. But they were beautiful girls, and they thought the world of me. Well, I was a young, good-looking lad. And they used to... I had my enamel pot, and he kept reaching out through the curtain and filling my enamel pot full. They kept it topped up with raised beer all the time I was there. We were there about a week. I was topped up with raised beer all the time. And then the star major came up. "Raised beer," he says. "Ah." And up he went, and they came back with a big jar of Rosa rum. Big stone jar of Rosa rum. And he tipped that into the end jar of raised beer. Or shall I say, the village had a village drunkard. And he had a big bamboo container strung around his neck full of raised beer, and he had a bamboo spoon. And he used to go around dipping it in, drink the raised beer with a spoon. He was mortal. He was mortal all the time I was there. He was drunk. This container. And anyway, the rum and the raised beer was a remarkable drink, a real reviver it was. And I remember one particular night I'd had my ration. I was off duty, and I was sitting there with the headman. I can only remember two words of Naga, is Amu and Ami. It's teeth and eyes. But anyway, he didn't know any English either, did he? But we got in there, we used to sit on these tree trunks, talking away to each other. Couldn't understand what each other was saying. Marvellous nights. And when I went and laid down on the bench beside the radio set, the two girls used to come behind the curtain and used to sing to me till I went to sleep. And I had they had lovely voices, and they used to sing in a duet, rather like Chinese, more than Indian, rather like Chinese. Beautiful, sweet voices they had. It was lovely. Home from home.
And the British troops got on well with them?
Yes. We weren't not to touch the women, no. Otherwise, we would get it, you know.
By the way, had you received rum ration on Kohima Hill? Were you getting a rum ration up there at night?
No. No, it came later on. No, we didn't.
What happened next then? You were there, you say, about a week.
I think I told you about the Arakan, where the sergeants got the rum ration. I did, didn't I? Yeah. So we were there a week. It was all quiet. It was a reserve position. The Nagas. I was going to tell you. You asked me before whether they fought the Japs. Yes, they did. The Japanese, in various villages, they had taken all the women away and put them in camps for sexual purposes, and the Nagas didn't like it. And I've seen them going out with shotguns. They were issued with shotguns, and they used to go out in pairs hunting Japanese down with these shotguns over their shoulder. God help them when they caught them. I don't know. They never brought any back. But they used to go there. And they were a lovely people. It's a real pleasure to meet them. I've never forgotten them. I would love to go out and meet them again. They'd be dead now, I suppose.
The British had issued them with shotguns?
Yes. The commissioner, I think. I think it was the commissioner had issued them.
Where were you receiving your drafts from? Where were they coming from? Were they Durham's or from other regiments?
No. There was an RASC unit disbanded. I believe we've got some of those. We've got some of our rear echelon people. A bit of a hodgepodge, really. As I told you before, we only had 3-week companies, so I don't really know. I wasn't really interested. I was looking after number one.
So where did you go to next?
We went forward then. It's a long job, this, isn't it? We went forward then. We went to relieve Imphal. We went down and we formed on the road in trucks, and we went down the road, hell for leather. Right down the road, which is a very winding road, and I don't remember stopping until we got to Imphal, and the Japanese were certainly not expecting us. Imphal is a city, I call it a city, it's a lot. I don't know how many, 160, 200 miles from Lakima, somewhere around about that, I don't know exactly, 180 miles, possibly, I don't know. But this winding road, and we went belting down this road until we got nearly to the outskirts. No, we didn't. We stopped. We had a bit of an engagement at a village. I can't remember the name of it. What I do remember is remembering what a filthy lot the Japanese were, because this camp, as I've told you before, they were busy building this road, and I think that this camp were the huts where the labourers and I used to sleep in. Well constructed huts they were, with bamboo sleeping beds and so on. And the Japanese toilet, they had made the toilets were indescribable. They had stood on the seat and so there was a few little incidents of spasmodic firing and so on, but there was no real defensive action by the Japanese at all.
Were they booby trapping as they retreated?
No. We went down. I hope I'm not forgetting anything here. I don't think so, though. We went down and we were in these open trucks. No radio communication at all. We were just with the rest of the infantry, and Imphal had been besieged for a long time with this other Japanese division. I don't remember the name of it, but it was another division of Japanese, and I'd ringed Imphal, and we came down the road unexpected and so fast, we bumped into all the rear of the defences. They were all facing inwards, and we bumped into the rear of them, and there were hospital stretcher cases, I don't think any hospitals, but anyway, there were stretcher cases lying by the side of the road, and all their gear and equipment, all of that, no defence at all. And they ran, they streamed up the side of the hill. You could see the hills over at Port, they're very high, 6,000, 8,000 feet, pathways, running, and you could see all the like little ants streaming up the side of the hill, and we all got down. And we opened up with everything we had, you know, Bren guns, rifles, everything, firing up this hill. Mortars were firing, building away at these Japanese going up the hill. And I'll tell you later on about what happened there. But so, one or two things happened, I don't know. You can't blame the lads. These stretcher cases, word came back, do not touch the stretcher cases. So our truck went by. And about the fourth, and all of a sudden there was a burst of Bren fire. Somebody swept the stretcher cases and put them out of misery. And so we went on, and I was in the lead with the leading truck when the tanks came out from Imphal. The beleaguered tanks came out. I remember being disgusted. We were in a hell of a state. We hadn't had a shave. We were filthy. And there we were. And they came out and they were all starched up. Beautiful starched short shirts. And spotless they were. Coming out on these tanks, shaking hands. And relief of Imphal.
Did you have any air support? Was that available to you? You couldn't call up air support if you wanted to.
We didn't need it. Once we broke out of Kahima, that was it, and it was the end of that part of the campaign. And 3 days after that, I went up with a platoon up a hillside. Shall I say at this stage that we didn't have any maps of the area? The only maps available were aerial photographs. And too often, when a patrol went out, they found a village which was a rotted away village. It was deserted and so on. These aerial maps were not reliable. They showed tracks which didn't really exist. They were all overgrown and so on. But we went up on a standing patrol for 3 days at a junction of these tracks to cut off any Japanese escapees. And As we went up the track, up the hill, up the mountainside, not the hillside, all these Japanese bodies, wherever the mortar bomb had burst, there was bodies, all the way up within range of rifle fire and mortar fire, and then it died out. But there were masses of them. They were carrying all sorts of gear. They had no transport. They had one man was carrying a shell and a bit of mosquito netting. All this was all man packed.
Were any alive? Were they all dead?
They were bloated. They were bloated, ready to burst. They were like dirigibles. Terrible, terrible state. And I've missed a bit out, you know, here somewhere. I missed a bit out. Anyway, we went up there on this standing patrol, and we came across a hut. The stench was indescribable. And when we looked in, it was wounded Japanese, rotten wounded. They were dying, gangrene. The smell, the stench was terrible. You had to hold the handkerchief over your nose. They were dead men. I don't know who gave the order, but when I moved away, there was bursts of stench and fire. Put them out of misery because they weren't savable. They were dead men, rotten dead men. So kill them. So we did that standing patrol for 3 days, and then we came back to the base.
Did you have?
Can you? I'm going to have to backtrack here. An incident which occurred. As we moved out of Kohima, we had to move up Aradura Spur, which was a very large sloping mountain, jungle clad. I remember on the way towards it, we were fired on by machine gun from the hill, from the spur, and we had to go off the road, and came under fire. We were in a sort of a valley and we came under fire. There was a shallow river down there, because I said, remember, there was a shell landed. That's right. We came under fire from our own guns. There was a short range shell with a short fuse fell near us, and we thought we were getting fired upon, and three or four of the fellas dived into this river, because it was only the cover there was, and they dived in this river. Cold water too, you know. So we got on, and we pressed on, and we went on Aradura Ridge. Advancing all the time. Advancing. We stopped there. Oh yeah, I shouldn't have missed this bit out. This is an experience. It was all uphill. All uphill, sniper, under sniper fire all the time. We kept losing men all the time. The snipers were up in the trees. And we kept moving up, and we got to reach the brow, and we kept digging in and digging in and digging in until we got over the brow of the hill. And then we had to cross a bridge. And the Japanese, noises had been heard, indicating that Japanese were destroying the bridge. So the battle patrol, which I've told you before where it was, the battle patrol went out along this road. We were about, I should imagine, about 8,000, 9,000 feet up in among the clouds. And we went along this road. We were going out as a standing patrol, not to fire, a listening patrol, to keep a check on this bridge to see if it was going to be suitable for us to cross. So we went out then. We went out in the morning. It was about 3:30 in the morning, around about then. And the battle patrol went out three sections with me and my two mates and the radio set in the centre section, in among the clouds. This road, which was all partially covered with ground, which had slid down with mud, you know, right across the road. I stood on a dead Jap, a dead somebody, and oh dear me, the smell was terrible. And we kept coming out of the cloud, into the cloud. The clouds kept drifting up. And we came to a part where the bank, the stiff bank, had fallen away and left this place to climb up. And the first section of the battle patrol went up, and then we went up with the Captain Wilson, Lieutenant or Captain, I can't remember now, Wilson they called him, and we went up and we were standing on the top of the bank in all the clouds, wondering where the first section had got to. We couldn't hear them at all. So we were standing there waiting before we went any further forward. The captain and I, signalers, and I were standing talking. Remember, like fog, the cloud was like thick fog. And there was a slope of grass, which we could see occasionally, and then all the trees, jungle. And we heard noises. We heard people talking. And we looked through gaps in the cloud, and we saw the lads coming back. First section coming back. Then we had another look and another one. And they were wearing capes, weren't they? And they had big helmets. And they weren't, there was Japanese retiring off the ridge. They were chattering away amongst themselves. They're terrible noisy people, but they had all their guns and everything all wrapped up in waterproofs and so on. And we saw them and they saw us. And they started knocking people, and we scattered down the bank onto the road. There was where the big bank had fallen away, we scattered under the road there. They didn't. The Japanese they separated. They went up and they cut us off both sides of the road. Machine gun up, firing down the road all the time. So we were there, and we don't know where we still didn't know where the first section had got to, but it was every man for himself. We were cut off. This broad road, two lane road, you know, Tom McAdam Road, and a steep bank on the other side of it. And so he says, every man for himself. Whenever there's a cloud comes along, run through it. So these bloody machine guns kept firing in all the time across the road to try and stop us, you know. But this big cloud came along, and we made a dash. I once again had this big rucksack on my back, and I slid down the hill. It was all mud. I slid down like a toboggan slide, till I caught up with a tree trunk between my legs. It was agony, Ivy. I could hardly move. But we got away, and we got back.
You didn't get time to send signals back, or
radio? No. We didn't have time to do anything like that. What was the good? The Japanese were retired, coming off the ridge. We told them when we got back where they were coming up. You see,
it's very hilly country you're talking about.
Mountainous.
Were the mountains or hills covered with jungle or trees? Or
well, as I said before, there was above the road. It was whether it had been clear or not, I don't know, but it was fairly clear. And then the jungle started so far up, thick jungle. It was a patch of clear ground. That's where we saw the Japanese coming out onto. You see. So anyway, I got back, and I had a messed in full of room for me. When I got back, we were pretty shaken up. There was one man, Beasley, I think they called him, Beasley. Out the first section, they had to leave him. He was hit, and they had to leave him. And we found out later on, the next day went back and rescued him, because these chaps just moved on and left. He had a pretty rough time. The Japanese, he was lying wounded. He shammed dead. He pretended to be dead at the side of the track. But even at that, they still stuck their painted tips into him as they went past. He was rescued the next day, but he died in hospital. I think it was Beasley, they called him. Anyway, that was it. I'm glad I told that one. That was another bright spot in my career.
Other than seeing or hearing of situations like that where wounded were treading that way, this wouldn't endear the Japs to you. You must have heard a number of stories of wounded being tortured.
We hated them. I still do. I still do. They are not a nice people. There's only a veneer of civilization on them. Don't forget that these people, the Japanese, in Queen Elizabeth, Queen Victoria's time, they're riding about in armour, fighting with swords on horseback. You don't just get civilised in a matter of, 80 or 90 years, you know. It takes time. In my view, they're still bloody heathens.